Scribe is the magic behind Colossus Transcripts, and Scribe is the presenting sponsor of this episode of Making Media. One of the best decisions we made at Colossus was transcribing all of our audio into a searchable transcript library. Now, we had been using another provider who won't be named up until the summer of 2022, but we were constantly having issues with the accuracy of our audio, even if it was just the slightest bit impaired or hard to hear. Scribe has solved those problems and more. So whether it's training sessions that you're having, internal Q&As, or for media purposes like ours, the value of transcripts is huge and probably bigger than I even ever expected. And we're not alone. Scribe is the service that powers all of S&P Global, like Capital IQ, and their client list also includes our friends at Tegas. So go to joincolossus.com/scribe, that's S-C-R-I-B-E, and you'll unlock 150 minutes of free transcription. Again, joincolossus.com/scribe to test their capabilities.
Let's do this.
Welcome to Making Media.
Humans are in an eternal quest for convenience. Save me time, make my life easier.
My gosh, that was such a good start to an interview.
All right, welcome back to Making Media. Dom, we are flying high off of our episode last week with Packy. I think it just proves the point. People love a list, huh?
Yeah, the stable is getting traction, and lists never fail.
Lists and rankings, I think they're the go-to when all else fails. If you want to build an audience, just tap into that. Auctions, drafts, lists, they are foolproof plans for content growth.
Well, I don't want to overdo them because I think it becomes boring. So, spoiler alert, we won't be overdoing them.
They will be sprinkled in to the broader mix of content, yes. But this week, I think the episode is particularly awesome because it kind of crystallizes the magic of content creation and what's possible. And there's a really interesting story behind it, which we'll get to. But I want to go back to one of the things that you highlighted from the last episode, which was this really important section in Kevin Kelly's 1,000 True Fans. And you had me thinking about it after the fact, after the episode. I think there's a piece of this episode which connects back to that. So, Dom, can you enlighten us again on the magic of peer-to-peer networks in a digital age?
I'm glad it got through to you because I kind of felt like I butchered it. But effectively, the most obscure node is only one click away from the most popular node in a peer-to-peer network like the internet. Effectively, he's saying companies like Google, Facebook, etc. found that the most popular things monetized or sold at the same rate as the whole long tail collectively, which meant that when they were putting their algorithms together, it was incentivizing them to surface not only the most popular stuff, but also some of the wonky things in the long tail, because they could sell ads against each of those, and they knew that in aggregate, the long tail would do a good service for them as well as the big popular hits. And you'll see when you go on YouTube, you'll see a lot of videos that have got millions of views, and you'll also see some that have got very few views. And you see the same thing on Amazon, Google, all of these places where the algorithm is doing a heavy lift, which is just a really interesting point for people like us who are in the podcast world or just generally in media, because it means that even when you're small, you've got a fighting chance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the easiest way to think about it is with Amazon, and you might have the Catcher in the Rye, which in a previous day and age took up significant amount of shelf space in any bookstore. In the online bookstore, The Catcher in the Rye is one click away from some random book that only 100 people have bought, but you can connect those things together fairly easily, truly one click away. How does that all tie into today's episode? I'm going to do my best here, but I do think it's the reality of these networks and these nodes and how this show at a very early stage is starting to show how all this works. So we reached out, as we had mentioned before, big fans of the Churning Group. We thought they would be excellent for Making Media. I have always found it fascinating how they have underwritten these creator businesses, which by any investor's standards are very tough to underwrite. You have single individuals who are the majority of the enterprise value in any creator business.
And most people would shy away from it. Most people would not attach large valuations when you have such large key man or key woman risk. And they've found a way to do it and found a way to do it very effectively. So I've always wanted to get into their minds in terms of how they think about the risk, how they think about all different things. And when we reached out to them, they did the honorable thing, which was talk to us about our show, but also say, we want to put the focus on our creators. And we have two right now, which might make four good options. You have Kevin Espiritu from Epic Gardening, who I wasn't familiar with, but I have absolutely gotten lost in the gardening content as a closet gardener over here. And then Doug Demereau from Cars and Bids. I knew Doug from his content fairly well. Somebody else had actually reached out to me and was like, you should have Doug on. I think he'd be excellent for this particular show. So I was like, this is ideal. We could collaborate with the Turning Group just to frame some of the conversation here in terms of how we can make it most effective for people that are building audiences, for creators trying to think about enterprise value in a business, for our own perspective in terms of growth. And it was really, really neat to see how that came together. And it's not the first instance. When I go to David Senra, who was just on Infinite Loops talking about how he did a podcast on Sam Zell, and a couple of weeks ago, he finds himself sitting down at lunch with Sam Zell or getting a letter back from Brunello Cucinelli after he does a podcast on him. We also did a podcast on Making Media that led us to a new Breakdowns guest who's going to be awesome and somebody who was on the list for a while. So to me, it's just impressive how you put these pieces of content out there in the world and they can connect into new nodes that basically give you exposure to an entirely different network. Do you think I did a good enough job in terms of connecting that to the Kevin Kelly?
Yeah, I think you did. It's kind of like the whole 6 degrees of separation thing among people, but just on an even more concentrated scale. It's not 6 degrees, it's literally 1 degree.
I think that's right. It doesn't have to be that exact node. And I'm using network terminology here and killing it to it a certain extent. But I think who you connect into is really valuable because sometimes those people will want to help you and see you create something around that. Doug is really interesting for a lot of different reasons. Were you familiar with Doug's work before he came in?
Yeah, so you might not know this, but I come from a big pedigreed background in the car business. My brother is an engineer on the Aston Martin hypercar program, and my sister-in-law is part of the Mercedes Formula One team. And then there's me. I'm an outlier within that. However, I do have a weird interest in car videos. And if you got a weird interest in that, then Doug is one of the people that you watch pretty consistently. There's something about, David talks about this all of the time. I could listen to someone with an intense passion in literally anything for hours on end. And I won't understand 80% of what's said, but I'm just captivated by the energy. And Doug has energy. I'm so excited for this because I've never talked to him. I've emailed him and the energy comes through the emails. But just when you watch his videos, he brings so much enthusiasm and personality to his videos that is, if I could mimic 10% of his energy in our podcast recordings, I think I'd be doing very well.
Yes. If someone hasn't come across Doug's videos, I would just spend a few minutes watching Doug's videos before listening to him talk. That genuine energy and excitement does not ever come down. It's like the caffeine level stays elevated. And I think that consistency seems like a really important piece of the formula. Obviously, we'll get into all of this. But I think that's what's most interesting to me is there's this genuine excitement around different things, almost this goofiness that gets him into your good graces because he's not trying to flaunt anything. The style of his videos has not taken a major step up as time has gone on in a good way. And from day one, I think about this a lot. His content has always focused on things you would want to know about. He's gone to the well in terms of reviews, but his earliest stuff was like, oh, you don't hear too many people talking about driving a Ferrari as a road car. I would like to do a series on this. So there's some interesting content lessons where he's never gotten away from what do the people actually want to be hearing about or reading about or watching. And I think that's pretty neat.
Yeah. And to your point, if you look at the branding on his YouTube channel, this thing must have been written word art 1998. And he just left it there, which I think is awesome. He understands what's important to his channel and the branding of it, candidly, is not that important, although it's kind of a vanity thing for the rest of us. And then when you get into it, he just presses buttons in cars and shows you what they do or like what they don't do. I was watching one with a Lamborghini. I think there was a button on the remote, which actually didn't do anything. It lit the lights up, but that was it. That really wonky stuff, which to his point is important. If you want to buy a car, you want to understand how all of these things work and exactly, you know, what does what. And he gets into all of those details and has spawned a cult following on the back of it.
Yes, cult following that he then translated into a business, Cars and Bids, which he started during COVID. This was the opportunity to go from content to commerce. But Doug's always seemed to have a knack for a business side of things, even just managing his costs. He's not just buying cars and adding the inventory. He's selling cars at the same time. So I think there's a business sense that he has, which maybe stands out and isn't as obvious, that attached to the following that he has, obviously makes him a pretty interesting partner for Chernin.
Yeah, and we'll get into this, but he has over 4 million subs on YouTube, and he does basically all of the work himself. He has an editor these days, but that's only in the last year. He's almost handed off the editing with some reticence because he quite enjoyed doing that piece of this. His best friend helps answer some emails, but it's just him doing all of this stuff. And then even on Cars and Bids, he runs a pretty light team there. So I'm very excited about this.
Absolutely. Well, we won't keep you waiting any further. On to the conversation, and stay tuned afterwards for our debrief. All right, Doug, so we're going to hit on a lot of topics here, but I wanted to start with my first exposure to you. I was browsing a message board, I Hate Mud, which is this forum dedicated to Land Cruisers and other off-road cars. And here's a video of you being fairly critical about one of these vehicles, not the Land Cruiser specifically, but a different one. And 99 out of 100 times in that situation, I'd expect a message board of enthusiasts to say, this guy doesn't get our brand. He's a generalist. But instead, I see all these comments like, I respect Doug, and I agree with Doug on these points. And it really stood out to me. It's one thing to have general fans, but earning the respect of brand diehards and enthusiasts is notoriously tough. So we're going to talk about all of the characteristics that make your content special. But if you had to key in and say, this is the trait that has earned me the respect of diehards, what would you point to?
I'd noticed that also. Sometimes, even if I'm like insulting a car, people believe that I have whatever it is, that they accept that what I'm saying is at least reasonable. One big thing is that my criticisms are never irrational. Like when you actually listen to what I say, even about cars that I'm criticizing, it's not stuff that is really disputable, or people who are disputing it are clearly so obsessed with that car that they've lost their rationality. And so I think there are some people in the car review space who do just level ridiculous statements to be incendiary. And I don't think I've ever done that. And I think that helps. Obviously, I think another thing that helps is that I have an incredible depth of reviews. And so people view me as pretty experienced, which I think is true. I've spent time poking around everything from Bugattis and Koenigseggs to Hyundai crossovers. There is the level of respect that comes with the knowledge that, hey, this dude has a lot of experience. I posted on my Instagram the other day that my new Carrera GT is, I think, the greatest sports car ever made. And someone who I guess didn't know me was like, how can you say that? Have you driven everything? And I'm like, well, actually, that's how I can say it. And I think that for people who are aware, that's a good component. And also, I think another thing is I own personally all of these cars. My list of cars that I've owned has been incredibly varied. I've had Korean, Japanese, American, Swedish, Italian, all of it, British. It has never mattered to me. And so I think people realize I'm not just some obsessed snob with only Land Rovers or only Volkswagens or whatever it is. And I really have dipped my toe into a lot of automaker pools. And when you spend your own money on something, that gives you a lot of credibility in my world. Because a lot of journalists don't, basically.
It was a great interview you did with Nilay Patel from The Verge. And you mentioned that you identify as a journalist, not as an influencer. But I think even in the world of journalism, there are certain things which can be questionable from a credibility standpoint in terms of taking test cars and getting free trips to review certain things. And you've always steered away from that, which obviously from our side, we admire. We certainly try to do the same on our side, but it can be tricky from a business standpoint because it's hard. There are certain expenses that have to be incurred, and it extends the time horizon in terms of when you can have the payoff. You've had this success story much longer than 10 years in terms of having it play out, and that has paid off. But if you had to give a new up-and-coming creator that same advice, would you tell them to go that same route? How do you balance those things?
That's a good question. The way these automaker press things work, the automaker flies a journalist, often business class, to a nice resort, some of the nicest places you've ever seen, all for free. And then they give you two very nice meals the night you arrive. And then the second night, they put you up in this hotel all for free. And then you drive around in this brand new, beautiful car that's full of gas, completely clean. just cruise around in some new city that's cool all for free. And then you're expected at the end of it to write an objective review of the car. But what is the alternative? I have always complained about this system, but the truth is I'm able to complain about it in part because I've been in a financial position to just pay my own way to these things. Like, I'm going to a BMW thing in a couple weeks in Scottsdale, and they're like, what do you need for flights? And I'm like, I'm doing it. And what do you need for dinner, hotels? And I'm like, I'm covered, don't worry. But not everybody can do that. Would I give that advice to an up-and-coming person? Yeah, it would be nice if everyone could do that. I think it adds credibility, but it's not feasible for everybody. However, I do think it is the most ethical thing. But car reviews, do they have to be incredibly ethical? It's not like we're taking down a president here with Deep Throat in a parking lot in Arlington, right? Like, at the end of the day, these are car reviews, and I think that most cars are good, and maybe I've pushed a little too hard on this, but I still believe that the right way to do it is to try to avoid that stuff when you can.
Yeah, it's hard to stay impartial when you've been flown in business class and eating nice food on someone else's cost. You also talked in that interview about half of your business is cars, but the other half is YouTube, and the greatest respect to cars. I'd like to spend most of the time talking about YouTube with you, because I think that's just so fascinating.
Everyone who comes up to me and wants to talk about cars, but YouTube is my life, and so I'm down. Let's do it.
A few people better placed as well than you to talk about it. Let's just start with the beginning for you of YouTube. Your background was writing for Jalopnik and Auto Trader, two huge car brands in terms of journalistic stuff. When did you first transition into video? And what are your earliest memories as you look back of posting onto YouTube? And what did you make of the platform? Like, what were you trying to achieve on there at the earliest points?
Jalopnik, I wasn't writing like blog posts. I was writing like humor columns. I would write like a 1,000-word humor column twice a week. Because I had a little bit more personality than just writing a blog post, a lot of the readers started to know me and get excited. And I got an email from a guy who said, you should make videos. This was probably early 13. I got an email from a guy, you should make videos. Truly and honestly, the concept hadn't hit me before that. And I was like, huh, videos. Like, videos seemed like something other people did. I wanted to be a writer. I still believe I'm a better writer than I am a videoer. But this dude suggested this, and it seemed like a pretty decent idea. And so I decided to give it a shot. And my earliest memories, one of the interesting things that I had going for me that in retrospect was maybe one of the biggest springboards I ever had was because I was posting on Jalopnik, those videos had a built-in audience from day one. So I never had to go through those trials and tribulations of trying to get hooked into the YouTube algorithm. My very first video was popular. But the drawback to that was my very first video had to be good because I knew people were going to be watching it. And that's hard. Like, if you've never done this before, so that video was 6 minutes long and I spent probably 2 days, which is like a commercial shoot with SAG actors and like union people, but it was me and a couple of my friends. My first memories of making those videos were getting really upset. My wife talks about the time I threw a stepladder. It was hard. It was like a prick guy trying to transition to digital. It wasn't that, but it had the same sort of dinosaur coming into the new age thing. And it wasn't for me. And it took a while before I became comfortable on camera. It took a while before I started to realize what people would put up with. It was initially going to be a companion piece to the articles. I never looked at my YouTube stats ever. And about 2 years in, I looked at the stats and I was like, this is something now. Like, holy crap. And by that time, I already had over 100,000 subscribers. And I didn't even realize that that was like a thing. I was so focused on being a writer. And I remember it was the summer of 15 and I was like, holy crap, I need to focus more on YouTube.
Notoriously now, you're a data guy. You transitioned from not looking at YouTube data to being very much obsessed with the numbers and understanding your audience. If you look back over the decade you've been on YouTube, if you were to put chapter headings on different parts of YouTube, as I guess people talk about the algorithm, but if you talked about YouTube itself over the decade, what will kind of be the chapter headings for the different stages and how you have to approach it?
The biggest change for me was a twofold change that I made at the same time, which was in the summer of 2016, I left Jalopnik and I started working for Auto Trader full-time, aside from YouTube. And I started posting twice a week on YouTube, and I started posting videos that weren't just about my own cars. And those two things individually blew me up. So posting twice a week got me a more regular audience. And at the time, that was a huge part deal in the algorithm, consistent posting and frequent posting. And I thought before then that the formula to do YouTube and to get YouTube right was posting about my own stuff. And what I learned quickly was actually people like the variety of cars to review. And so in the summer of late 16, I started reviewing more and more different cars. I rented a Tesla Model X on Turo and did a famous, this is a terrible car video, but I disproved all these bad things that people said about it. And then I started to realize, like, I need to start doing stuff with other cars. And that's when things really started to take off, when there was a new car in the video basically every week, essentially, twice a week.
It's interesting to me because you came from a writing background. It sounds like you really think about yourself as a writer. Many people come into the creator world or just the media world, and they come through one medium. You already had an audience. You're already getting feedback from your audience. You already had some flexibility in terms of the content that you created. So what was it that was happening in video that kept you going? Was there something that kept you attached to that format? Was it always the business side of the equation?
Looking back, it's hard to remember now. That's a good question, because I wasn't earning any money. I didn't start earning actual money from YouTube until I started doing that two videos a week thing, which was in the summer of 16. My first video went up in late 13. So throughout 14 and 15, I wasn't really paying that much attention. I guess the thing that kept me doing it was the fact that people responded better to the articles when they had a video component to them. Jalopnik would post my articles and embed the video in it, and it simply drove more. And I felt that maybe some of the video traffic was coming to the article. In retrospect, I think that wasn't true, but that's how I felt. It endeared people a little bit more to me. They were able to connect with me on a more personal level because they saw me on video. And so I think that must have been it, because it was a lot of time and I was not making money. And I really didn't think it was something that I would be successful at. Back then, I looked at YouTube as something that other people are successful at until it started to take off for me.
And now when you go into the dashboard, what are you looking for? Like, what are you tracking over time? What are the things that are important to you?
The number one thing I look at is monthly views. It's interesting because every YouTuber kind of has their own way to measure. And people come up to me and say, oh, so-and-so has X number of subscribers. I couldn't care less about the number of subscribers, because people lose views. Subscribers are not all that sticky. And sometimes people subscribe because one video went viral and then they stop watching. To me, consistent monthly views is a massively important thing. That's the thing that I always look at as my North Star. Am I still doing well? Am I still in the range I want to be in? And if I am, then I'm happy about how things are going. Obviously, everybody looks at stuff like watch time, that kind of thing. But I don't think I specifically look at anything different than other creators in terms of that stuff. But monthly views is like a really, really big one for me. To me, that is the biggest public indicator of the health of a YouTube channel.
It seems like with your content, you've played around with knowing the audience cares about certain things like reviews versus a series of episodes connecting to the same topic. But it also seems like you do certain episodes which maybe are more for you. How do you mix that together? Because obviously the enthusiasm has to be there. And I would say that you're consistently enthusiastic across any episode that you do. So that doesn't fall off. But how do you blend testing out different formats, just following what the data tells you, which I think can become boring and maybe become a slave to it? How do you mix those things together?
One of the most interesting things that happened is, since I launched this auction website, Cars and Bids, the stuff that you're specifically talking about is like the difference between new cars and older cars. New car videos I love doing, but sometimes I'm reviewing a crossover and I don't really care all that much. If it was up to me, I would mostly be doing 80s, 90s, 2000s cars. Honestly, those cars, as they age, are just becoming weirder and more interesting. But 2 years ago, the data was telling me people don't care. They only want to see the new cars. And I was ready to give them up. And I think one of the things that Cars and Bids has given me is I don't have to quite care as much about the views, because I can now go after the cars that some of the cars that we're selling on the site, which has been like a totally amazing new pipeline of these used cars, these cool, weird, old school used cars. And that has allowed me to kind of have a renaissance, actually, of fun and interesting cars that I enjoy doing. They don't make as much money, but they convert to the site more. So I can justify it now. And that has been a huge, huge, huge benefit for me in like, hey, I can still do these older cars and I can still create a business reason to do these older cars. That's been an amazing savior of my happiness and excitement over the last couple of months.
We've talked about this before. You kind of need to be selfish as a creator, because you first need to feel yourself to be sustainable. Like, the only way you thrive is by first surviving. And like, you have to have that thing that keeps you coming back, particularly if you're making two videos a week. I mean, that's pretty impressive. A lot of people have opinions on YouTube and you see a lot of different things written and said. What is not discussed as much as it should be from your perspective when it comes to YouTube? Like, what do you see not said out there?
This might sound corny, but I think a lot of what you hear about YouTube is criticism. They got rid of this feature, or they doing this. That's bad, big, bad YouTube. I tell my YouTube rep, YouTube changed my life. It was an amazing thing for me personally. And it allowed me to get out there in front of an audience 10 years before I would have been able to do that if I had gone a traditional route and gone to Michigan and worked for Car and Driver. And it's like the democratization of content. And it gives you the ability to have access to all these things you wouldn't have before. DIY stuff is a huge thing, right? You can learn how to do so much stuff and get so many answers right away. There are decisions that YouTube makes that make it seem like a big monolithic corporation, and sometimes they seem a little punitive. But I think often in the discourse around YouTube, people don't talk about how beneficial it's been, not only for individuals, but society. And again, I think it sounds a little corny to be like, YouTube is great. That's what people are talking about. But I think that is lost sometime in a discussion of YouTube and what it is and what it does. It really has been beneficial, and it has certainly been beneficial to me.
That makes a ton of sense. You talked about a rep. How much contact do you have with YouTube as a business, either through your rep or someone else? How does that work?
From the podcast side of things, we do not have a lot of contacts with our reps. So that's where that comes from.
As I've grown bigger, I've gotten more contact. I think as they've realized, hey, this is a big voice on the platform, I have something like 1.8 billion views now. But I have a rep who's now pretty involved. He's around when I need him and he's not when I don't. And truthfully, I'm pretty self-sustaining, but he would be around as a good resource if I needed him more. I've also always been pretty independent as a creator, and things have always, frankly, gone relatively well. I don't have issues with copyright strikes. I don't have music in my videos. I don't have like profanity issues. I've never really had demonetization problems. So I've never really had to pursue a relationship with YouTube around that kind of stuff that I think a lot of creators probably have. So generally speaking, I have a relationship if I want it, but I haven't really needed it all that much.
Probably a good time to dive into what the production process behind the scenes looks like, because this has been fascinating to me doing more research on you, exactly how asset light it is on your production side. Can you kind of talk us through what goes into a video these days? You talked about 10 years ago, you massively overthought it. What does it look like today now it's a well-oiled machine?
Well, I think one of the real keys to YouTube, this is probably the advice that I should give to young creators. One of the real keys to YouTube is you don't have to produce amazingly expensive content as long as you produce good content. So people laugh at me. The production process is I have a 4K camcorder, which is relatively expensive, and then some good microphones. Other than that, I have a $40 tripod I got on Amazon, and I have my iPhone, which is also just my personal phone. And then there's a mount for when I'm driving and the thing looks at me. That's it. That's the entire thing. I fit it into a briefcase. People will get angry. Sometimes I'll be shooting something on my iPhone and the car will have a glossy thing. So they'll see a reflection of the iPhone and they'll be like, this guy produces on an iPhone. This is ridiculous. And I'll be like, yeah, but I've been doing it for 1,000 videos, literally. And you didn't notice until now. How can you get mad? My goal has always been to keep it simple. And I think that a lot of YouTube channels and creators especially try to go into this direction of super high production quality, which makes everything harder. And it's not better necessarily. The audience doesn't need it. And it adds an enormous amount of complexity to a lot of shoots. So I've always been like a keep it simple. Also, the more people you add, the more BS you add. The more schedule problems you start to run into, the more HR interpersonal drama you run into. And I'm just like, screw it. I just want to be me. When it came time to launch Cars and Bids, I was trying to find the right partner. I couldn't really. And I was like, I'm just going to do this myself. I'm going to learn to code and I'm just going to make this website myself. And of course, that would have been the stupidest thing I ever could have done. There was a time to be super light and there is a time to not. But I still, to this day, am super light on production, value, and content. And some people don't like that, but I really think that's been a key to my longevity on YouTube, honestly.
Steven Soderbergh shot an entire movie on an iPhone, so I think you might be a pioneer. It might be moving more in your direction.
I recently ran into another YouTube creator who creates very high-quality content, and he told me that he was like super, super burned out. And one of the things he told me was he wishes he had never done that to begin with because now his audience insists on it.
Yes.
And he's screwed because he can't walk away from that format and that quality.
A piece of that also makes a lot of your content relatable to me. I think there's some creators where you start to see a world around them that just looks overly, insanely luxurious with this gloss. And you've stayed in this like relatable way for a decade where the success has gone up, but it really hasn't changed that. Is that a intentional decision not to embrace a lot of the nice things that I'm sure you could have in the same way that some others do? And sometimes maybe they don't necessarily have them. They might be leasing them.
It's not like I'm fooling anyone. Like if you ever see me on the street, and a lot of people bump into me on the street, obviously, I'm wearing the same stupid shorts and t-shirt that I do in the video. Like, I'm not putting on something here. This is it. This is all. I have some nice stuff that maybe doesn't make it into the videos all that much that I don't really talk about. I have a ridiculous amount of cars now at this point and all that. I guess that does probably make it into the videos. But when you really start to add it up, it's like, wow, that really is a ridiculous amount of cars. But this is still just who I am. And it's actually interesting because I've met a lot of people doing these videos. As you can imagine, I've gone to a lot of rich people's collections to film a lot of their videos. And some have been the worst human beings you could possibly imagine. I never want to see them again. And some have been super down to earth. They were just like normal people who got rich. And I guess that's kind of my situation, if you want to look at it that way. Some people don't think that about me, I'm sure. But it is relatable. And I think that's just how I am. And I'm not putting on any airs or anything, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, authenticity works. All of this stuff just speaks to the nature of how the cost of production have come down in a ton of different mediums. Podcasting is exactly the same, but with that, competition tends to go up, and I think we've seen that. And you can go on YouTube and there are a ton of people talking about cars, and you can get any flavor of car review that you want from any type of person. How have you felt that personally over the decade that you've been on the platform talking about cars? How has it either changed what you've done, or how have you leaned into different aspects of it? Seeing more and more people doing what you do, whether that's had an impact on growth or monetization, any of that kind of stuff.
There has definitely been an impact on growth. When I started this, I don't want to say I was the only guy because it's not true, but my first hook was I bought a 2004 Ferrari 360 and I made videos about it. That car cost $85,000. At the time, that was enormous on YouTube. Some guy on YouTube has a Ferrari. It was like crazy that this could be happening. And people would watch my channel just because it was like this guy showing people what it's like to own a used $85,000 Ferrari. You know, that's like the cost of a BMW 5 Series now. But over the years, that's not a hook that would work anymore. That's not something. A used Ferrari on YouTube is like a laughable thing at the and honestly, a lot of really wealthy people have tried to buy their way into YouTube with buying crazy cars, Bugattis and Koenigseggs, and it hasn't worked. What they've learned is you actually need a personality. But more people have shown up, and I think YouTube wants to make sure that creators have a chance. And so I think to an extent, they do pull back some of the legacy guys who have always been big and try to push out some people who are young and up and coming because they want those people to have a voice also, which I think is reasonable. So I think competition has definitely impacted. I used to be at 25, 30 million views a month. Now I'm 15 to 20, which is still an enormous number, but it's not where it was. Now there's other factors as well. One is that I think that I've done all the craziest cars. I did the Enzos. I did the Countaches. That's all kind of behind me. So now I'm mostly doing new cars that people who are watching are in market to buy. And also there's other platforms that have come up, TikTok and others. But I think that other creators and the ease of content creation has definitely fractured people's watching in a way that 10 years ago it wasn't. And I think YouTube is becoming, in a sense, a little bit more like the Netflixes and the Spotifys. You can watch any number of different types of shows that are perfectly tailored to you. And I think that YouTube is becoming more like that too. And I wonder if there will be simply fewer and fewer huge, massive creators and instead a larger number of smaller creators that are specifically tailored to people's interests.
Yeah, really interesting. And you talked about the different platforms that have arisen over the last decade. How have you thought about them as someone who's predominantly been on YouTube, thinking Twitter, TikTok, any of the other ones? Have you ever tried in earnest to go after one of those and build another audience there? I know you've got decent scale on a lot of those platforms, but not quite to the same extent that you do on YouTube.
No, I've never thought about it a ton, in part because YouTube has always been in a growth phase for me right up until we started Cars and Bits. And then my energy changed a little bit. And YouTube is still a massive part of my life. It's still almost all of what I do. But my focus was a little changed when Cars and Bids launched, and I realized this is something that I need to focus on a little bit more. And so as TikTok has risen, I have focused on that quite as much. So, of course, there's the drawback of monetization on TikTok. Because you can't monetize it all that well, almost incentivizes you to do the type of paid promotions that I have shied away from, as I believe that a journalistic endeavor shouldn't really be taking money to say stuff. The TikTokers that make money all do that, which is fine. They don't call themselves journalists. They don't care. They're making money. It doesn't matter to anybody. But for me, I don't really want to go on TikTok and then start having to shout out brands. It's not really my ethos. I guess the answer is I need to have more of a presence on those. And I think that's going to be a focus going forward. But I took off with YouTube and then took off more with Cars and Bids. And these other things have popped up in the last 3 years. And it hasn't been as much of a focus for me, but probably should be a little bit more.
Well, it brings up an interesting quote. We'll start to transition a little bit. I definitely want to get into cars and bids and the business idea behind that. But when you first came to the agreement with the Chernin Group, one of the quotes you had was, they understand paid marketing maybe isn't the best way to achieve growth. Maybe it's going after people that are naturally there because they love the creator. And I kind of wanted to tap into that a little bit. What your view was on paid growth, but also just growth in general prior maybe to some of these platforms rising up, and how you aligned views with Chernin Group in terms of some of those things.
You think about private equity. What I think is someone comes in, spends a big amount of money and starts dictating because they don't get it. When I launched Cars and Bids, we had always kind of gotten emails from day one. Hey, we want to buy you. We want to invest in you. We want to do this round, whatever. And we honestly ignored all of them. Our thesis was always that we need to grow it big enough that it's actually attractive and we're actually get the investment that we need to make our investors happy, our initial investors. These guys are going to show up and they're going to say, we need to spend this much on digital marketing and screw this. And I think it's very rare when you find a business that is a private equity firm or any type of investor who understands the value, who already understands. The rest of them will eventually, but who already understands the value of these content creators are bringing people here. And people show up on Cars and Bids not because I paid them to, and on my channel, because they want to be. And that is cheap marketing by comparison. And if you have a business where you're earning $100 million a year, but you're spending $75 million a year on marketing, is that even really a business? Is that something? If you turn off the tap tomorrow, would the business just cease to exist? Having people there because they support me, because they understand me, because they get it, is an enormously important thing. And as I was building my YouTube audience, I was very wary always of doing sponsorships and of doing merch. Buy my t-shirt, because I always felt there was a bigger opportunity there. And then I did it. And I think that it was absolutely essential to partner up with someone who understood that.
It's my new excuse for why we don't have a merch shop after all these years. So I think I'm going to put that one in the back pocket. I do want to give you some credit here, just in terms of the business mindset that you've had since day one. I think if I just go back through this conversation and things that I've observed, you've kept your costs low. You've thought about different platforms and not becoming a slave to one thing. You've looked to extend yourself from one medium to the next. Was the jump from content to commerce, from YouTube and writing to Cars and Bids, always something that was in the back of your mind? Because even from an investor standpoint of the type of business to start, a marketplace, if it works, is a beautiful business from an investor standpoint, from a cash flow standpoint. Was that in the back of your head? And you can lie and say that, yes, that it was, and you were this visionary. Share some of that insight.
Once the audience got big, I started to get anxious because I realized that it won't last forever. I had to do something with it. Beginning in 2018, I had this anxiety within me all the time. I need to do something with this. So I wouldn't say it was always on my mind. It wasn't something I was thinking about the whole time, in part because I didn't know I would get that big. But I would watch what would happen to certain other creators, where their views would slow down and their traffic would slow down and they wouldn't be as big anymore. And I was like, I need to capitalize on this before that happens to me. It will happen to me, just like it happens to every musician, just like it happens to every actor, whatever. Like, it will happen to me. For athletes, I liken myself to a professional athlete, you know.
Yes, practice. Different forms of it.
Right. I just figured this is going to happen. I really need to do something with this. And so once the audience got big enough, there was like a fire. It was like something else. I have to go this direction. And so that was always kind of the thing that was on my mind once that happened. Now, I had no idea what to do. And creating a marketplace is a brilliant business if it works, because you don't own a lot of stuff, but it's also really hard. And if I could go back, I'm not sure I would have done this. Obviously, now I would have, because we got a lot of money and succeeded masterfully, and it's going to be great. Who knew that a two-sided bringing together buyers and sellers so damn hard? Good idea. It's actually interesting because I think less sophisticated people see Doug in his stupid t-shirt and shorts with his stupid iPhone, and they're like, screw this. I can do this. This idiot can do it. I can do it. Try it. It ain't easy.
I think there's been many great papers and great stories about how marketplaces can be amazing and a lot of analytical work. We've had Bill Gurley on the podcast. He's written some amazing things on marketplaces. But the reality is they are amazing businesses. If they work, they are very hard to make work. And not all industries are set up to be situated for marketplaces. It doesn't make sense for everything. He has this famous example of obituary writers. Doesn't make sense a marketplace for obituary writers.
A good chunk of the reason I succeeded is because we didn't know how hard it would be when we started. And I actually think that a lot of my success has been, if I had known how difficult this would be, I would never have started in the first place. But now I'm halfway through, and so I'm just going to do it. And there's something to that. It's better to not know what you're up against. It's better to not have a buddy who already tried it and failed, so you know how hard it is. It's better to just be like, I could do this. And then you just have to, because you started.
Was there any taking the pulse of your audience on YouTube and just engaging with them about what products you could build for them, and that ended up in this marketplace? Or was it not quite as linear, or you can't draw the line quite as cleanly?
That's a great idea. I probably should have done that. And I literally have never considered it until this moment. I never even thought about, should I ask my YouTube audience, hey, what do you think? No, I never did that. We truly had no idea if Cars and Bids would be successful until we were.
Yeah.
I mean, I still remember the terror on launch day, because we had no idea if anyone would come at all, if it would exist at all.
Well, June 2020, there wasn't anything going on then either.
I guess so, but that was actually a big reason why I thought it would fail.
That was complete sarcasm in terms of economic concerns.
It is sarcastic to say that, but there kind of wasn't anything going on. Everybody was at home. As it turned out, people started buying stuff. People were bored. They weren't doing much, and they started buying stuff. And so, like, the car market took off. We launched into what I thought would be a failure because it was COVID and the economy was tanking. I mean, by June, things were a little bit back to normal. I mean, there was no vax. Everybody was indoors. We launched and I thought it would fail in part because of that. And it turned out we launched the single greatest car market in the entire history of the automobile. But who knew? Who knew that that was going to happen? And it just worked out okay, I guess.
What did the growth strategy look like at the beginning? Was it simply you talking about Cars and Bids on YouTube in your normal videos? Was there any paid marketing behind it? How did you guys think about that in the early days to get liquidity on both sides?
We didn't think about it much. We should have done more collabs. But I just kind of figured, hey, you know, maybe this will work if I mention it. June of 2020, I mentioned it in a video, and I think I've mentioned it in every single video since then. We've always done a little bit of paid marketing because I think you have to, but just pretty minor.
It was uncomfortable for you at the beginning, talking about Cars and Bids?
It was weird to sell people something, but my thought at the time and still, and I think my audience kind of agrees, at least I'm selling you something that I've built and is meaningful to me and it is real for me. And I think the difference between that and going in with an ad for a shaving cream or a chicken, or I don't know what the hell people sell on YouTube, but you see those ads in the start of videos, like the video stops or they integrate it somehow, but it still comes off as super disingenuous. I really think that if I'm saying, hey, this is my thing that I have done and I have built from the ground up, people identify with that a lot more. And so I didn't get the pushback that I expected to, although it did make me uncomfortable to start.
I'm just curious, is there any way to measure the demand and transactions and where they've come from and how many of them trace back to fans? Is there any data that's interesting that can prove that out?
Attribution is hard. Especially on a marketplace like ours, because it's not like you just show up and buy something. Often you show up and then months later you buy or sell something. We're only selling things that people buy once every so often. So it's not easy, but for a while, the only people who were showing up were fans of mine. Occasionally now, we'll get some people, because I write a Doug's take in every car, and occasionally now we'll get some people who will be like, who's Doug? Why is he commenting on my car? Like, what the hell is going on here? And so that's great, I think, actually, because it shows that we've a little bit transcended just fans of Doug. The metaphor that I think of is like a snowball rolling or something you're pushing up a mountain down a hill. And are we to that point where you can just let it go and it will continue on its own? And I think it's hard to know when you're at that point, but I think we're getting there or there. It already exists kind of apart from me.
That sounds like the perfect excuse for you to stop writing those reviews, because I saw somewhere that you'd said that that was the stupidest thing you've ever done, is to commit yourself to writing a review for every car that's listed on the site.
We have now moved it so that the people who edit the listings write them, but I review every single one. In fact, when I'm getting off this podcast, I'm going to spend an hour reviewing the next couple of days worth of auctions before they go out to the sellers for their approval. So I still look at every one. It was stupid to do that. I do think it was a cool hook at the start. I still think it's important because it's like a nice summary of the car. And I love the excuse to check out every single car that goes live on the site. There's not a single car, even when I had a baby, there's not a single car that I didn't pop into for a second just to see, okay, what is this? Is this the kind of car? Does it fit with us? And what's going on with it? Every single car. It's important that someone does that who's in a position of power in the business.
These things are tough because it adds to the authenticity. It adds to the genuine comfort in putting your name behind something. And yes, these things don't perfectly scale. There are issues with it, but it's hard to detach yourself from all that. So I completely get it. Tapping into the Churning Group and then coming to that agreement, obviously a big step for you, big step for the business. It attaches your YouTube to Cars and Bids, to that business. I'm curious, if you go back in time, I'm sure when you had a huge YouTube channel before you even launched Cars and Bids, you were getting outreach from different investors, and there's a lot of money in the system, particularly at that time. When did you decide that bringing in capital from the outside made a lot of sense? And how did you go about looking for partners? Because I think what's interesting about creator businesses is a lot of them are just not built to sell. When you have your name attached to everything, go back to that original point, that things are somewhat linear and harder to scale. So just bring us behind the scenes a little bit in terms of how those conversations went over the years and how you ultimately came to working with them.
You're right. I mean, I think that that's been one of the big drawbacks that a lot of these creator-led businesses can have, is that they're too specific to the creator, and so you can never really exit. In retrospect, I probably shouldn't have named the channel after myself. But in terms of relatability and that kind of thing, I think that helped to an extent. People knew Doug. And in the car world, now you just say Doug, and everybody kind of knows. I've always hated my name. I think it's a ridiculous name. But now it is very useful because it's an unusual name instead of just being another Mike that's out there, basically. So when we first launched, we had kind of a firm that like seeded us, essentially, and we just needed some expertise. And when we then pursued the Churning Group investment, we didn't pursue it. Their pitch was, we get it. We get the space. We understand you and we understand creators. And we were kind of at a critical point where we knew we wanted to grow, but I don't think we felt we were equipped to be the ones to do it. So me and my co-founder is an awesome dude and I love him. And he was amazing at getting the business to where we got it to. But ultimately, we're not business runners. He's a good startup guy to like start something, get it off the ground and get it going. And I make YouTube videos for a living. I'm not a CEO. I shouldn't be managing people. It's simply not what I should do as a job. We were at this point where the business had grown to a certain level and Churning came to us and was like, here's what we can offer. We can help you grow and we get it. I think those two things were just music to our ears at that exact moment. I think had we held on, we probably could have kept it going and grown it more over the next couple of years and potentially gotten more when we took an investment. But I think the real crucial thing here was we're going to be able to accelerate this more than we could have if we had just hung on. And I think it would have been hubris to just be like, forget you. We're just going to keep going because we know what we're doing. I'm thrilled. We announced this. The deal was kind of in process over the summer and sort of closed in late fall. Even since then, it's been clear. I like to say we have adult in the room now. And that has been really helpful in directing this business.
There's a hilarious story about Churning with Barstool and their investment there and how they went in to look at the books. And basically, everything was run out of an Excel sheet. There were all these invoices that they hadn't received their money. They had assets that included racehorses and a van, and they had to figure out how to separate some of that stuff. But they got it. It was like, you focus on the content. We'll help you out with the business side of the operations. I can only imagine that the gap was not as big. There were some cars maybe on the balance sheet, but
it wasn't as big, but it's an interesting business strategy. Churning strategy is interesting because they're going after these creator-led businesses. And often, I bet the Barstool story, because everybody knows Barstool, that's told. But you got to assume that was the case for almost every one of these. Let's be honest. No YouTube creator like went to college for YouTube creation. In fact, they usually got big on YouTube because they failed out of something else or wanted to do a normal thing. And so they're kind of insane people to begin with. Usually their books are being done by Uncle Lester, who got a finance degree in 1974. So he can do it. I bet that story has repeated itself quite a bit. And so that's an interesting thing that the Churning Group does, going after these creators who probably are a little insane and have their own weird, insane peccadilloes. But I think that also benefits them because those guys probably aren't optimized. And that's probably true for me, and we're getting there now. And there are ways to improve process and ways to improve throughput that an investor like that can come in and say, here's what you should do. Here's what we can help you with. And so I think, yeah, it's a weird business model and it probably creates more work for them, but I think there's probably more upside.
From a practical standpoint, what does it look like now for you working with Cars and Biz and your YouTube channel and also working with TCG? How does it work kind of on a week-to-week basis?
Because this was a startup, my time over the last 2 years has been, I had my hand in like every pot, which was hard. I did maybe half of the reserve setting. So people would submit their cars and I would like be the one who would reply and offer them a reserve. And I was doing those Doug's takes. I mean, there was all sorts of stuff, commenting on, hey, we should prop this photo more, whatever. And already I'm starting to see that this is becoming a more mature business. We only have 20 employees, which isn't a huge amount still, but it's not the six-person startup that it was where we were all doing everything. And so I think I'm going to go back over more towards the content creations, focus on YouTube, focus on collaborations and partnerships more. And other people can do more in terms of day-to-day like running of the business, which is how a mature business should be run. I, the content guy, that's where I can add the most value. Now, the sad part for me is I actually enjoy the business component of it hugely, and I find it to be tremendously interesting. But I'm most useful in the content component. That's where everybody knows me. I can't exactly extricate myself from that. So I think that'll kind of be my continued role. Although that's fine too. I still love doing the car reviews.
Well, you can sell the board now as well, and you can tell people what they should be doing without having to do the work. That sounds like the perfect balance there.
Exactly. Although you'd be surprised how much fun it is to do the reserve setting. You'd be stunned the kind of weird cars that get submitted to us. We're kind of have a reputation for having weird cars on the site, but you'd be stunned the kind of really weird stuff that doesn't make it on the site. Illegal stuff comes in. So I miss that component of it for sure. Rollback tow trucks. I mean, just cranes. People submit the craziest crap that you've never heard of. I'll miss that aspect.
Might have to be a spin out eventually in the future. You know, the crumbs that are left on the table.
There's something to that. Like, here's something we can take, but there's a video about this.
Yeah, once there's enough of them, we'll keep the illegal ones out. But the rest of the stuff, the really funky stuff, you could start that. You mentioned before how they're doing something very interesting. And I agree. Coming from investment backgrounds, most creator businesses, the amount of friction associated with underwriting someone who... Listen, if you decided I don't want to make another video, nobody can step into Doug's channel except Doug right now. In the future, maybe that's different. But do you think there was a specific thing that they zoned in on for you that was a major make or break in terms of making that investment?
I think they liked the fact that we were already profitable. It was the exact type of business they invest in, which is a creator-led business that has brought the creator's audience to a business. I mean, I think it was like a right down the middle of, now that I know them, right down the middle of the Churning Group playbook. This was not a business that was like fledgling or needed a lot of help. It wasn't a business that was so late stage that the cost to acquire it would have been ridiculous. It was already like a pretty reasonably acceptable, rational business, and it had the creator component to it. One interesting thing that I think about a lot is what you just said. They bought a majority of the business, and that's true in most of their cases. The creator is so integral to the business, technically they own the majority, but like at the end of the day, I find that to be the craziest part of their business model in general. That would scare me, but it doesn't scare them. I think that they sit down with these people beforehand, and I think that they have a really long vetting process. There were a lot of phone calls. There were a lot of conversations, personal, professional. They really make sure that they're getting someone who's not just going to take the money and run. But it's weird. It's a weird business when you think about it. Usually when a private equity firm comes in and buys a majority of a business, they install people and they can take it whatever direction they want. But they actually have to deal with me, who's kind of the funnel. And so it's a weird way to run a business for sure.
Yeah, it was even when I took this job, Patrick, it was basically all him. And if he decided he didn't want to do his podcast anymore or something happened to him, then we didn't have a business anymore and I'd have needed to look for another job. So it's definitely a really interesting aspect to these businesses. If you sit down with a friend who's in a similar position to you as a content creator with a large audience looking for either a second act or investment in whatever they're doing, what sort of things would you be telling them to think about or to look for?
First off, I would tell them to do a business that's easier than a marketplace. I'm not sure is the answer.
Do you have a good example?
Do a podcast? No. I don't know is the answer. I'm not sure. This is what I did. And I don't consider myself a business expert. Clearly, I wouldn't have done this if I was. But I am telling all of my content creator friends to do this. I think that the benefit of it is so clear now. It helps you kind of get off the train of just having this as your only thing. And I really think, I'm not sure exactly what I would say to pursue something you're interested in, something that you think is fun, but I definitely would say, take your audience. And I've actually had heart-to-heart with a few of my creator friends recently. And I'm like, while your audience is big, do something with it. Think hard. You have time, but do something with it. I think it's really important because one day you're going to look back and you're going to not be as popular as you were. And you're going to say, I wish I had.
Yeah, it's kind of a defined moment in time when you can do it. How do you manage the transition? I mean, you talked about the peak of your YouTube channels before Cars and Bids, and it's come down a little bit in terms of growth. Yeah, I imagine you were stretched pretty thinly when you're trying to get Cars and Bids off the ground, and your YouTube channel necessarily suffered a little bit during that period. So is there a lesson there of how to manage any kind of transition?
It's hard. I tell everybody that I will never start another business. It was really, really tough. And I think, honestly, that's the number one reason why most creators don't. They're like, what do you mean, do another entire business? I'm already traveling to all these shoots and filming all these videos, and it's already so difficult. What are you talking about? Do another thing on top of this. They think to them, like, I can't afford to do that. Like, I don't have the time. My response is, you can't afford not to, in my opinion, when you look at it long term. But yeah, it was tough. And I wouldn't do it as I get older. I have a kid now. I don't think I would want to do it again. I've watched some of these people who get very successful starting one business and then they go off and do it again. And I think that's insane in a lot of reasons. It's tough. But I think if you want to take this space to its natural conclusion, which is a creator doing the most they can with their audience, you have to suck it up and do it. Deal with the fact that you're going to be in startup hell pain for a year or 18 months or 2 years. And you hopefully you come out on the other side with a career GT.
Yeah. And don't do your own coding.
Imagine if I had done that. I'm sitting here talking about how hard it was. And meanwhile, in summer of 19, I was like, I'm just going to learn to code. What an idiot.
Well, learning to shoot videos, it seems laughable now, but in the early days of YouTube, that was seen as very unique. And I know it's different, but I have some experience of proving that you can learn new things and new techniques and make a success out of it.
That experience is dangerous because it taught me I do anything on my own.
Yeah.
What I learned is I cannot do anything on my own. I actually need help.
Ignorance is bliss, like you mentioned. There's a good takeaway there. Wind down the conversation. I have one broader question about the media spectrum. You were in what I would consider traditional media. You came from larger outlets that had audiences, and you started what built into a massive audience just attached to you as an individual. And I think we've seen that happen in other places as well. So when you think about, on a go-forward basis, the media landscape, do you think that this shift just continues to more of a creator or individual-led media landscape? Or do you think that we've kind of reached a peak? Do you have a strong opinion on what the next 10 years look like after a very clear 10 past years?
Don't you think that the future is more of these creators?
I wouldn't be in this chair if I didn't, I'll tell you that.
It's an interesting question, but like as I look at the churning thing and as I look at some of these other creators who have done similar things, and there's now several, you talk about the Kardashians, which is like an obvious one. They have a massive following and turn into massive brands. You got Mr. Beast and Jake Paul, but there's a lot of little ones that not everybody knows about. Cars and Bids, honestly, and me, like if you're not in the car space, you might not know, but it's something. And I think that those legacy media companies should start thinking about entering the creator space by making investments like the one that the Churning Group is making. When you think about how people interact with brands and how they get where they want to go now, a lot of the stuff people buy and a lot of the content people consume is them going after creators and people that they like and care about. I think that that makes sense to me. In my mind, as I see it over the next 10 years, businesses started by, pushed by creators are going to be some of the most important investments that anybody's going to make.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. A more specific question for me. You started another channel called More Doug DeMuro, where it kind of takes people behind the scenes of your main channel, which is not dissimilar to Making Media and what we're trying to do here. Although if we could have a tenth of your scale, we'd be very pleased with ourselves. Specific things about starting a second channel and how whether you felt that there was a different audience there, how you interacted with them, what you got out of it personally, any reflections on doing that?
I started the More Doug channel. It was probably summer or late 18. And I stopped doing it, actually, about 18 months ago. And I started the channel simply because what happened was my videos all follow basically the same format. And what I discovered was that that was fine and it was great and it was doing great, but it didn't give me an enormous opportunity to like innovate or be creative. And I only got to this point because I was innovative and creative. And so I was like, I want another outlet to do that. But I was worried that if I started doing videos that weren't in the regular format, the algorithm and the viewers would kind of punish me and say, I don't want these. I only want to get those that are in the format. And so I decided I would make a second channel so I could have a little bit more fun. And on that channel, I did some crazy stuff. I reviewed houses. I reviewed a ridiculous hotel room in Las Vegas. I did do a bunch of behind the scenes stuff, some off-roading stuff, some stuff with my friends. Like, it was great. But over time, I think that the algorithm has evolved. I think that YouTube watched all these people making second channels and then were like, how can we figure this out? And I think that what I have discovered is actually, I've switched back to the main channel. I think that the algorithm and the viewers are smart enough to figure out, okay, this is a regular format video versus this isn't. And frankly, the main channel just made more money. Once I felt that the algorithm caught up, I was like, I'm just going to take those More Doug videos and put them on Sunday on my main channel and make more money doing basically the same thing. And so that's what I did. And so there's this More Doug channel. I was like 750,000 subscribers and it's just lost in ether. It's just gone. But I think it's the right move, maybe.
Fascinating.
It's a great artifact in the history, a digital artifact left for us to ponder over. It's great to hear that you refer to the algorithm as a living being in the same way that we do, in the same way that Mr. Beast does. It is somewhat hilarious, but also the reality of the world that you have to view this algorithm as this villain, partner, thing to understand, thing to tame, like it's a wild animal. Where 30 years ago, if we heard in a business setting someone talking about the algorithm in such a way, we would think it's some dystopian movie that we're talking about.
Especially because it has so much control. And honestly, that's something I haven't discussed here, but that's one of the most important reasons why I feel that it's important for creators to start getting off of YouTube. The algorithm, which does change, it does move around, but is this kind of monolithic thing that has a lot of power. They control it. The reason that I tell these YouTube creators to start thinking about how to get off and how to do something else is not get off. I think that the YouTube platform is they should stay there and continue using that as a funnel to drive for whatever they do. But to start thinking about a different thing is because this algorithm, they could turn off the well at any point. Now, people say that. The truth is it's not in YouTube's best interest to just snap their fingers and you're done. But it is in YouTube's best interest to keep younger guys coming up and other people kind of churn around. And so you don't want to just live in a world where your entire income, net worth, lifestyle is by something you can't see. And that is the number one reason why I tell my creator friends, you got to figure it out. And yes, it does sound a little dystopian, especially what if 20 years ago, some business had been like run by the algorithm, but that's the world we're in now, I guess.
The conglomerates of 50 years ago is the algorithm of today in many ways.
Right. But yeah.
Awesome way to bookend the conversation. Doug, thank you for joining us on Making Media. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
What a champion.
Seriously. Completely authentic to a T. Bring you behind the scenes. Since we've been emailing back and forth with Doug, he's managing his own schedule. He's incredibly courteous, over-communicative over email, just specifying things when he hopped on before the call and after the call, very personal. You can tell that what you see in the content is clearly, as he said, what you see on behind the scenes as well. It was just awesome.
I'm a little bit concerned that he stopped his More Doug channel, given that I thought he was going to say, really enjoyed doing that channel, and then I clear path for Making Media, but I'm not quite sure what to make of that one.
He merged that channel basically with his existing feed. It was purely born out of the algorithm, but he merged it. He knew that's what the people wanted. He just made it even more of a part because he needed to serve it to a bigger audience. I actually took that as a positive for myself.
Yeah, Patrick, watch out. We're going to put this in MS Like the Best soon when the algorithm lets us.
In due time. No, I thought the conversation was one pleasure. He has a business sense that I think goes massively underappreciated that I often think creators, not that they should be focused on just the business dynamics, meaning dollars and cents, a financial mindset that I think really is easy to overlook, but low cost of production with the videos. When you listen to how he shoots and how quickly he's able to churn out the content, thinking about a marketplace business, understanding why that would be such an attractive business to launch, I think it would be easy to look at him and say, he's just another creator that makes content out there on YouTube. and not appreciate that he's moved from medium to medium. He's thought about costs along the way. He's thought about different revenue and diversifying the risk. And that, to me, stands out in a really cool way.
So true. We talk about culture a lot, but really with big firms, but I think you can have a culture and just kind of a philosophy as a one-person creator. And he definitely has, like, if someone says, come to my press event, I'll be paying for myself. I'll be getting myself there. I'll be paying for my own meals. He could very, very easily have someone who shoots his videos for him and he just needs to talk. He could probably have someone write the script for him, have someone who edits for him, but even that's kind of a new thing. All of those things just speak to the way he thinks about his business. And as you say, it's, no, I can do this stuff myself. Yeah, I'll be busier for it. And even when he started Cars and Bits, he didn't change too much of his setup, which he very easily could have done. But he probably thought it would reduce the quality. I enjoy this stuff. And also I'm watching the bottom line, which is really interesting.
Yeah, he said it without saying it. The fact that he did it for that long without focusing on the dollars and cents means like he actually enjoys the content itself. But then to graduate beyond that and say, okay, how do I turn this into a real business? He's done that insanely well. I thought the point on credibility and thinking about yourself as a true journalist with integrity, it's something that's like, I'm trying to find the right guest to have for a conversation about product placement. Because it's this dark world of marketing, sponsorship, dollars associated with content that don't get picked up as much as a traditional sponsorship. When you do an ad read, it feels different than if I talk about a specific product in an organic conversation. It's James Bond holding a Heineken or wearing a Rolex or an Omega watch. And apparently it's like a $20 billion industry. And there's different versions of it, right? It's all just like a degree of sponsorship. Am I going to call out that this is an ad placement and I am talking about this product? Or am I going to write an article where I'm not receiving necessarily revenue for writing the article, but I'm having my expenses paid, different form? Or I might be getting paid to place it in the actual piece of content. It's like a really interesting world where the ethics are really gray. It's a huge industry. Without a doubt, it's more effective to me. If you don't think that something is an ad, the second you hear ad placement, you do have to adjust the credibility factor. And that plays a role. So it's really interesting to me. And then hearing his approach to it and how he's differentiated himself and pointed it out too, that helps. You have to make it clear why this is different than others. It's pretty cool.
He could very easily do it as well. I'm sure there's a ton of different brands and products in the car world that he really enjoys using and buys his own cars that he could very easily get into partnership with. I'm sure they would love to have him talking about their products, and I'm sure he could do it in an authentic way. So it's interesting that he resists that urge, even when I'm sure there's a range of products that he would happily talk. And even when he was talking about his Carrera GT, he was talking about the place he goes and gets a service from, and he said, this is not a paid ad. This is the de facto best place to get your Carrera GT serviced if you're lucky enough to have one. So it's definitely unique.
It gets into the list of potential partners where we have a lot of people that are interested in sponsoring Colossus that we would never actually have sponsor Colossus because we don't agree in the product or don't necessarily align with it. But they often are the ones with the largest sums of money. It's not easy to say, I want to keep my integrity and all this. You have to keep the lights on. So it's tough. And he probably has some like more in-between versions of that where car brands trying to build up names for themselves and get more exposure. So to stay away from that is pretty big. I know you had a list of about 436 questions on YouTube during the interview. Did you get all those in there? I had like a full 5-course meal while you were asking those.
Yeah, I got 387. So I did pretty well. I felt your stare. And after a while, I was like, I think we're probably through with my YouTube questions. The biggest thing from that passage of play was when he talks about, I have a low production value, if you like, but I've seen people go really high early on, and then you just have to keep that bar over time because people tolerate fine production. I'd say it's pretty good. It's definitely on the more budget end of someone with a big audience, but then accept that. Once you set expectations, it's really hard to come down, but you start low, then you can go up or you can just keep it as it is. I think that's really smart.
When I was making the joke about being done talking about YouTube, I actually was intending to not talk about YouTube, but I really appreciate how much you love this content. I agree with you. The production quality and all the considerations that go into that. He had a lot of interesting things to say. I was not tired about hearing the questions, even after I tried to steer the conversation in a different direction and he went back to the well.
I wouldn't be doing my job as head of content if I wasn't asking about big platforms such as YouTube.
Yes, we certainly have enough there on that one. Also, fun little anecdote, the car that he reviewed that he really hated on, that he was very critical on, was the car I ended up buying 4 years later. I didn't want to share that with him on the podcast because I agree with all the points that he made. There are certain things about the car that are outdated, not updated. It's special to me, and I really wanted this car. And even after he said that was, I forget what the exact terminology he used, but I would say it was not a glowing critique, and the headline certainly was not. I mean, that introduction to Doug, to growing respect, to having him on the pod, that doesn't tell you the story of somebody who is authentic. I don't know what does.
I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed you didn't tell me that piece of information when you told me that story the other day. I could have used that with Doug, built rapport. We could be two against one, i.e. you. But no, he left that until now, and now I have no recourse to use it.
You would have been too busy asking you two questions to ever get to building any rapport with him. That was a scroll. Our Google Docs with the questions are usually pretty evenly matched. Dom had like six paragraphs of things, and I was just kind of wondering if he was planning to do this one solo. Glad we made it out of there alive as a team. Hopefully post-editing, I have some features in that interview. We'll see.
You'll be in the introduction for sure. I think the burning question that Doug posed to us and other creators out there is, what is our second act going to be?
I don't think we're there yet. We have to focus on the first act, and then we'll get to the second act. Content to commerce can come in a lot of different forms. Patrick has the most natural content to commerce with Positive Sum. He never lets that get in the way of Colossus. If there were opportunities for Colossus to capture upside and that in any way were to ever interfere or come across as a conflict of interest with their LPs, it's a no-go, which I admire. I respect it in the same way that the Churning Group wants Doug on the podcast more so than talking themselves. That's an admirable thing.
The one thing I would say is we've definitely failed to save the past year with something like Twitter, which used to be a decent engine for growth for our podcast. And I think we've just seen that dial back significantly to the point at which, you know, we've talked about how the newsletter now is becoming more important than Twitter. And I think if you'd told us that a year ago, we would have looked with some concern at you. You definitely know as a content creator that you're at the mercy of the platform that you're on. Obviously, Spotify and Apple are the other two big platforms, and we're seeing some changes with Spotify at the moment. Unsure as to how that changes things for us as a business just yet, but it will be interesting to see. Hopefully, positively interesting thing.
Yeah, you either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself slinging out content on LinkedIn, whatever I've been doing over the past few months.
Anything else that stood out for you from the conversation other than my many questions on YouTube?
No, honestly, I really enjoyed it. Doug, I think, brings very interesting case study as to someone who figured out this content to commerce thing on their own and was a success story. And when he was saying that for the Churning Group, it was kind of right down the middle, it checked a lot of boxes. I think that's 100% right. Couldn't have described it any better. Yeah, I think there's a lot to learn from Doug, how he did it, how he did it differently than I think a lot of the advice that's out there. What you hear from him will be in contrast to a lot of people that will share advice in terms of how to build things. So I appreciate that. Interesting to see what he does from here, because I don't think his story is over by any means.
No, I agree. And there's something refreshing about someone saying, I don't want to build another business. I've been through a couple of years of really, really hard work, and I think I'm probably good there. I'm going to go back to the thing that I love that gave me this opportunity in the first place. I think you can get sucked into a vortex of thinking that you need to be doing something for the rest of your life, working 9 to 9. And I think it's something refreshing to see someone who's done a really good job, be very successful, and willing to dial it back and just go back to Nantucket shooting car videos twice a week.
We were a wrestling podcast. We would have Senra come in now with a steel chair and just smash it over your head and said, my retirement plan is death. And that's how we'd end it. It is good to have a mix of views and opinions on the topic. I agree. Doug might be more relatable to the everyday person versus the founder audience.
That's exactly who I had in my mind. David, I'm talking to you. I'm not saying that your strategy is wrong. It's just might not be for everyone.
I love it. Awesome. Well, another excellent episode. We got more fun things on the docket. As always, if you have any feedback, shoot us a line at hello@joincolossus.com. That inbox has been blowing up with all different types of interesting messages and things. Secret admirers. We're having interesting conversations with different people in media. Lots of good stuff going on. So keep that coming. Keep the DMs coming. Keep your eyes peeled for more stuff from Colossus as a whole. Thank you very much.